said, Job, if you're not hearing him, the problem is that you're not listening. And then in the second speech, Elihu responds to Job's position as Elihu perceived it, and that is that God is unfair. Now, I think Job had not used that language specifically, but certainly one who sat and listened to Job. As Job said, look, I have not sinned to the degree that I deserve what is happening to me, and who called upon God to lodge a formal complaint against him. Let me know what's wrong. Who questioned God. Certainly, Elihu could have perceived that as an accusation that God was unfair. And so, in his second speech, Elihu, in responding, tries to establish that God is not unjust. And we'll begin looking at Elihu's second speech. In Elihu's first speech, Elihu reasoned with Job. When we reason with people and they reject our reasoning, what very often follows? Anger. And that's sort of what's happening with Elihu. In this second speech, Elihu is no longer reasoning with Job. He is attacking Job to make a point. And as we go through verse 34, we will see Elihu's point discussed in about verses 10 to 30. But flanking Elihu's point in verses 2 to 9 and 31 to 37, we're going to see some pretty strong attacks on Job. Now, Elihu, of course, has sort of indicated that while wisdom may not die with those three friends, it may well meet its demise when Elihu is gone. And Elihu sort of seems to think that if Job doesn't understand that he is the voice and the personification of wisdom, that something is really wrong with Job. About the only thing that Elihu could say to Job would be, Job, I guess you're just not as dumb as I thought you were, because nobody could be. Sorry, I didn't take a minute, but think about it. And so he starts out, then Elihu continued and said, hear my words, you wise men, and listen to me, you who know. That's pretty tall cotton for a fella, isn't it? You wise men, you folks who know, listen to me. I'm going to tell you all about it here. For the ear tests words as the palate tastes food. That's a pretty statement, isn't it? Elihu's not all bad. That's a pretty good statement he's made there. In fact, it sort of reminds you of the book of Proverbs, doesn't it? A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. Isn't that a beautiful picture? Proverbs 25 and 11. You know, one of the nice things about being the teacher is that you study the lesson in advance. And you come in and you cite passages like Proverbs 25, 11, the class thinks, boy, he really knows the Bible. And all the teacher's done is study a little bit. It always gets me when the teacher comes and says, all right, does anybody know what Proverbs 25, 11 says? And nobody does. Then the teacher can look really smart. As Pat says, what a surprise if someone does. For the ear tastes words as the palate tastes food. The palate tastes the variety of flavors and sensations that comes from that which is eaten, and Elihu says that's what the ear is to words. It hears the words. It discerns the words. The ear tests the words. Let us choose for ourselves what is right. Notice in verse 4 that Elihu switches to the first person. Now what's he doing there? Let us choose for ourselves what is right. Isn't it a common approach in, I start to say discussion, but maybe debate's a better word, maybe argument's even better. When we start feeling that we need some support, what do we do? Everybody knows this. Everybody believes this. Anybody who is anybody understands this. So that those who oppose us begin to think, am I standing out here by myself? Am I the only one? Well, I guess I must be wrong. Elihu here is aligning with himself. All of these wise people, everybody who knows anything, let us choose for ourselves what is right. And in this verse, verse 4, he starts one of his strongest, maybe his strongest attack on Job. Now remember, one reason that Elihu was reluctant to speak was because he was young. And he sat back and waited for the older men to finish what they had to say first, to see if everything could be resolved, if they couldn't get where they needed to be. Having failed, he comes in and makes his speech. And you recall that he said, now, I'm going to be impartial. I'm just sort of a mediator in this thing. Now, we've talked about a mediator in the book of Job. We understand what a mediator is. A mediator is somebody who is a go-between. But when we start looking here at what Job is saying, what Elihu is saying, and his condemnation of Job, is Elihu acting more like a mediator, or is he acting more like a prosecuting attorney? I think we'll discover that it is the latter. Let us choose for ourselves what is right. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said. Now, always listen closely when your opponent starts quoting your words. One thing that I always tell my witnesses when they're about to be deposed is that very often the lawyer in asking a question may say, well, this morning you testified A, B, and C. Now, I want to ask you about this. Said, you listen very carefully to what he says about A, B, and C, because I guarantee you that it will be stated in the manner most favorable to him and may be misstated. And about 99 times out of 100, it is. I don't blame him. I do the same thing. So here is Elihu, and he's starting to tell us what Job believed, what Job has said. Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my right. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. Now, did Job say those things, or is this an exaggeration of what Job said? The right answer is the latter. It is an exaggeration of what Job had said. Job never did accuse God of calling him a liar. As a matter of fact, what Job has been complaining about is not what God has said, but what God has not said. God has not lodged a formal complaint against Job, and that's what Job is wanting. Let's get into court. Let's talk about this. Let's see the evidence. That's what Job has been suggesting that God needs to do as far as he is concerned. So Elihu starts by exaggerating what Job has said. And then he sort of repeats an insult of Eliphaz. But he enlarges that insult with what is a groundless accusation against Job that he's the companion of evildoers. What man is like Job who drinks up derision like water? Now, verses 7 through about 9 here are especially sharp words. And you keep in mind as you hear these words that Elihu, as we've said, is a man who has claimed to be an impartial mediator or judge. Does it sound a little bit like he's got his mind made up before he hears the evidence? Job drinks up the derision like water. He goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men. Has Job ever done that that you and I know about? Where do you get this? Out of his own imagination. It sort of makes his point a little bit better. And so if I can make my point a little bit better, then I just exaggerate the opposition's position. I add things to it. I attribute to them qualities and characteristics that they do not possess. For he has said, it profits a man nothing when he is pleased with God. Job has said, Elihu suggests, what good does it do me to be obedient? What good does it do me to obey God? I have obeyed God and look where it has gotten me. Do you find that statement in any of Job's speeches? Don't think so. Now, Job has said such things as, well, the judgment that we would expect to fall on the wicked very often does not fall on them. And you remember where Job has suggested that the wicked seem to go wrong, they seem to prosper, everything seems to be good and beneficial for them. He said that no farther back than in chapter 21. Back in chapter 9, Job has said that trouble and suffering come to the good and they come to the evil alike. But the one thing that Job has never said is that God does not take notice of the obedience of his people. Job is being charged by Elihu with being an unbelieving cynic. And Job is not an unbelieving cynic. Job is one who believes in God. He is one who all along has trusted in God. He has maintained that trust in the face of his suffering, in the face of his losses. Though he slay me, Job said, yet will I trust him. And that's what Job has done. Now, Job is troubling Elihu, because along with trusting God, Job has the audacity to question God. God, I want to know why. God, I want to know what's going on. God, come into court with me and lay the charge and examine the evidence. And Job has said, if that happens, I believe that I will be exonerated. But Job has never said that if I obey God, it will not do me any good. So Elihu has made his attack upon Job. He's got his audience ready. This man is no good. This man can't be trusted. This man doesn't believe in God. This man is an unbelieving cynic. Now hear my charge against him. Gets to his point. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to do wrong. All people, Elihu suggests, must certainly agree with me that God always acts consistently with His character. Nobody has ever disagreed with that. Job has not disagreed with that. But that's his beginning point here. Down through in verses 10 to 15, Job repeats the self-evident truth that God can't do any wrong. And nobody disagrees with that. Job certainly hasn't. So God is going to act consistently with His character. God's not going to do wrong, for He pays a man according to his work and makes him find it according to his way. Now, have we heard that kind of language before? If you are wicked, if you are evil, what does God do to you? He zaps you. And Job, if you have been zapped, that's a sign that you have been evil. And if you'll be good, be a good little boy, God will give you an ice cream cone. God will bless you. God will provide you that which is good. Have we not heard that all the way through the speeches of the three friends? Absolutely. That is their position. And Elihu has done nothing more than revert to and repeat the position that the friends have asserted to Job. Surely God will not act wickedly and the Almighty will not pervert justice. God is going to punish the wicked no matter how long it's going to take. There will be payday someday, and that is true, isn't it? As a matter of fact, you recall that in the beginning of the book of Job, one of the things we talked about was that one of the difficulties we have is understanding why the wicked do prosper. We sing a song sometimes. I never do lead it. Tempted and tried. We're oft made to wonder. And we talk about farther along, we'll understand. We don't need to wait to understand that the wicked prosper in this life because all of God's accounts are not settled in this life. Job has described what we have observed, and that is the funerals of the wicked with their great processions and their great limousines with their fine caskets and everything that goes with it, the finest things that money can buy. But God doesn't settle accounts at funeral times either. And the only way that we can understand the lot that goes on his life is to look at it in terms of the last day, when God will come and He will give unto every man according to his works, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or whether it be evil, as Paul described it. But that's last day. That's eschatological times, as they are called. That's the end time. And that's not this life. But you and I, as we go through life, need to remember that there will be payday someday. And that applies not only to those out in the world who appear to be wicked, but that refers to you and to me as well. When all the secrets of men shall be made known, And we shall each one of us stand before the judgment bar of God and receive the things done in the flesh. Surely God will not act wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. God's not accountable to anybody. Who gave Him authority over the earth? And who has laid on Him the whole world? The implication is nobody. God has it because He is God. Not too long ago, our little 6-year-old grandson looked at his mom and said, "Who made you boss?" He learned pretty fast. He lost interest in that question and didn't like the answer. But that basically is what Elihu's getting at here. Is who made God boss? God is boss because He is God. It's inherent in His nature. He is the Creator. He is the Maker. And the pot does not say unto the potter, "Why did you make me this way?" God has authority because He is God. Everything depends on God, who may indiscriminately withdraw this gift of existence according to Elihu. And if He withdraws that gift, then God has done nothing wrong, if He should determine to do so. If He should gather to Himself His Spirit and His breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust. Now His argument here seems to smack of might makes right. God is God, and nobody questions what God does. Nobody questions the way that God can go. And Job, part of your problem is you've been questioning God. You've been saying, "God, why?" You've been saying, "God, explain to me." God doesn't owe you any explanations. Elihu tries to wriggle out of his difficulty, I think, by falling back on the doctrine of the friends, and that is that God meets out behavior, meets out His blessings or His punishments based on behavior while this life is going on. And that is what we talked about in verse 11. But Job, if you have understanding, hear this. And in verses 16 to 20, Elihu talks about the fact that God is the impartial ruler of the universe. He is the one who judges kings. He is the one who judges all men. He judges these kings without partiality. How do men treat folks in that position? Our new Secretary of State says she's going to tell it like it is. Maybe she will. I hope she does. Her job tenure may not be too long, but maybe she will. But when men get in the presence of, for lack of a better description, those who fall into the category of grand high potentate, what do? Don't we sort of tend to flatter them? Tell them what they want to hear? how great they are. And pretty soon they start believing it, don't they? How great they are. One fellow I know, we kid him. He's got a very high opinion of himself. Talk about him one time talking with an interviewee. And he told him how, you know, wonderful he was, what a great lawyer he was, how lucky everybody was to be around him. He finally said, but that's enough talking about me. Let's talk about you. How great do you think I am? Well, when we get around folks like, and they really have the position to go with it, we sort of tend to flatter them, but God is the impartial judge, Elihu is saying. But if you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Shall one who hates justice rule? And will you condemn a righteous, mighty one? How could God be the ruler as he is if he were one who hated justice? No way. And will you condemn a righteous, mighty one? God is righteous. Will you condemn him for his righteousness? And when we deal with human governments, and you've got the king, and especially back in the days of Job, now a lot of countries still have kings and queens today, but they're sort of constitutional monarchs. They are there because they have always been there. And their power, by and large, has been stripped away. All they have left, the castles and the money, and I guess that's not too bad. If I can get a castle, a lot of money, and very little responsibility except to go out once in a while on the balcony and wave to some folks, I'd be very happy. But in this day and age, if you were the king and you went up, somebody went up to the king and said, King, you did wrong. Oh, really? Well, why don't you just put your neck across this block here? Oops. Body on one side, head on the other. You didn't question the king. And if that's true about these earthly monarchs, isn't that much truer about God? As Elihu continues, who says to a king, worthless one, to nobles, wicked ones? And some translations render that, is he not the one who says to the king, worthless one, to nobles, wicked ones? God, he doesn't care who you are. You may be the king sitting on the throne. You may be the one with the power. You may be able to take the lives of countless hundreds of people who live in your domain, but God takes no notice of that, and if you're doing wrong, God calls you a wicked one. He doesn't show partiality to princes. He doesn't regard the rich above the poor, for they are all the work of His hands. God made every one of them. In a moment they die, and at midnight people are shaken and pass away. And the mighty are taken away without a hand. Elihu argues that God's knowledge here is complete. It's infallible. And so his actions are beyond human comprehension. They are beyond human questioning. God will do that which is right, and he does it without partiality. And after all, God's angel of death comes to the mighty, and it comes to the weak, it comes to the rich, it comes to the poor. And God has no regard for any of them. He doesn't owe anybody any explanations. Doesn't matter whether you understand or not. God is God. And all of us are the work of His hands. And being the work of His hands, God can do what He wants to with each of those things. For His eyes are upon the way of man, and he sees all his steps. Verses 21 to 30, Elihu continues to explain that God only is all wise, and that God is all just in his governance of the world, and that he sees and knows everything that is going on. His eyes are upon the way of man, and he sees all his steps. God is the omniscient judge who sees and knows everything. There is no darkness or deep shadow where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. Maybe you and I need to stop and listen to this just a little bit. Everything that you and I do, every place we go, every thought we think, every word we speak, God sees, God hears. Where shall I go to get away from God? If I go to the heavens, thou art there. And if I descend into the deep, if I go into Sheol, thou art there. God is everywhere, the psalmist said, Psalm 139. Let me ask you something. Husbands, if you're wise, strike that. If I wise, and I think Millie may have this power, I'm not sure. But if our wives knew everything that we thought and that we did, would we think some of the thoughts we think and do some of the things we do? Same question for the wives. Probably most of us aren't so old, but that we can remember when we were younger. That we did things or at least thought about doing things that we hoped our daddies and our mamas never ever found out about or heard about. Why? Because we knew they were wrong. And because we probably knew that if they found out about them, we'd be in big trouble. Do we ever stop to think that everywhere we go, the eye of God is upon us? Do we ever stop to think that every word we speak, the ear of God hears? Does it ever dawn upon us that every thought we think, the mind of God perceives? Or is God really somebody who is just so far off yonder? So removed from us that we never think about Him and we fail to understand that He is in truth and in fact, as Paul described Him, Him with whom we have to do. His eyes are upon the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. There's no darkness or deep shadow where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves, for he does not need to consider a man further, that he should go before God in judgment. Now, why is Elihu talking about all of this? Because Job has been saying, God, come down, and let's have a trial, and let's get a verdict rendered. And Elihu is saying, God doesn't need that. God doesn't need to have a trial. God doesn't need to go through that with you because God can render that judgment without ever having a trial. God knows it. He breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry and sets others in their place. You ever heard language like that? Boy, sure put him in his place, didn't I? Well, I hear saying, here's what God can do, and he doesn't need to make inquiry. He doesn't need any kind of examination. Therefore, he knows their works, and he overthrows them in the night, and they are crushed. Now, Elihu sort of comes back here, maybe to try and ease things a little bit, by suggesting, don't think that because God has not yet judged the wicked, that he's not aware of what they're doing. God is aware of what they are doing, and he sees it all. He strikes them like the wicked in a public place because they turned aside from following him and had no regard for any of his ways. God will take care of them. Don't worry about that. Their judgment will come. They had no regard for any of his ways, so that they caused the cry of the poor to come to him. It may be that Elihu is suggesting here that these wicked people have persecuted the poor. They've taken advantage of those folks that are poor, and the cries of the poor have gone up to God, and God will respond to those cries. And God will take care of the wicked. And the punishment of God will fall upon them. And that he might hear the cry of the afflicted. When he keeps quiet, who can condemn? And when he hides his face, who then can behold him? That is, in regard to both nation and man, so that godless man should not rule nor be snares of the people. Elihu says, Job, no explanation is necessary. And if no explanation is necessary, what then follows? Does it not follow that Job has no grounds at all for coming to God and seeking a trial, seeking an explanation, asking a verdict? It further follows that Job doesn't have any complaint because God has been silent. God is under no obligation to speak. He is under no obligation to explain. God, after all, is not beholden to any man. He doesn't owe anything to any man. Certainly, he doesn't owe any explanations to man, which, as we talked about a week or so ago, in any event, man may not be able to grasp. And that is true. Even though, as Elihu suggests, God sometimes seems to have withdrawn his hand from the course of events on the earth. Surely God is not doing this. But Elihu says, even when it seems that God has withdrawn his hand from the course of events upon the earth, that God is still firmly in control. And if God seems slow to act to you and to me, Elihu says, that isn't any indication at all that there is a lack of sovereign power on the part of God. God is still able to do what He wants and when He wants. And if He's not doing anything with you, if He's not talking to you, and if He appears unjust to you, then, Job, that's just tough. You have no complaint. You have no basis to question. Just sit there and be quiet. Verses 31-33. Elihu suggests that Job may ask God why he is suffering, but the one thing he may not do is to ask God to act as Job thinks God should act. For as anyone said to God, I have borne chastisement, I will not offend anymore. Teach thou me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do it no more. Shall he recompense on your terms because you have rejected it? Shall God come and behave as you want Him to behave, Job? Are you the one, Job, who has the right to dictate to God what He shall do and when He shall do it? Again, a good question for us, isn't it? Aren't a lot of our problems with God the fact that God doesn't behave as we think God should act? Our conception is that God must do good. And good is defined by our standards of good. Well, let me suggest to you that if God must do good, then good is elevated above God and God is not God. For there's something that is greater than Him and that dictates what He shall do. The better approach is not that God must do good, but what God does is good. And that also, I suggest to you, goes to what God instructs us to do, both to become Christians and to remain faithful Christians. Well, I can't see why God would insist that I be baptized for the remission of sins. So I just won't do it. Your terms are God's. Which? Well, I can't see that God would insist that I do this in order to be a faithful Christian, and you can fill in doing this with all of the things we talk about all of the time. Your turn? Or God's turn? Which? Who has the right to set the condition? Am I God that I should do it? Are you God that you should do it? The question answers itself. The only question that remains for you and for me is, shall we submit to God or shall we rebel against Him? Oh, well, I'm not rebelling against God. Really? You consider your children disobedient? When you tell them to do something and they say, well, I don't think I need to do that. Let me just say in kindness that any sentence that begins with, I can't see, admits blindness. There is only one who can heal that blindness. and that's Jesus Christ. We'll start there next Lord's Day morning. Appreciate your presence and your attention today.